Well, good afternoon. Welcome back to part two of Ethics Refresher 2015, which we're doing today live on June 21st, 2015. It's a conference call and also as a an online podcast for later download. Those of you who are listening to the podcast, during the course of the program, I will be giving a couple of code numbers. And please write those down during the program, and you'll submit those to me with your request for the certificate of attendance. The procedures vary a little bit from state to state, so check my website, but in any event, you will need the code numbers that I'm going to give. And this is a continuation. We're going to cover part two today, starting with Rule 1.7 of the Rules of Professional Conduct. If you just stumbled across this program and wondering how to get credit, you can visit my webpage, richardclem.com, and get the full information. But with that, we're going to continue just plodding through the rules of professional conduct as adopted in most states. We're kind of focusing today on Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota. And the rules are more or less identical in those states. When we get to differences, we'll point them out. But these are all based upon the ABA Model Code of Professional Conduct. So you'll find very similar rules apply in most states. And Rule 1.7, where we're going to start today, covers the general rule covering conflicts of interest. And this is certainly one area where you're really not going to get a lot of value out of the program just by reading Rule 1.7, because this is one area where you do have to dig in a lot deeper usually than just the actual text of the rule. But for purposes of today's program, we're really just looking at the text of the rule. So you're not going to become an expert on conflicts of interest today. Although perhaps in a later program, I will delve into this in a little bit more detail. Because all Rule 1.7 basically says is that a conflict of interest is a violation of the rules. But it doesn't give a whole lot of guidance other than to give a definition of a conflict of interest, which is you can't represent one client directly adverse to another. Obviously, that's an extreme case, and you realize you can't represent both the plaintiff and the defendant as they sue one another. But the general rule is that you can't represent one client if there's a significant risk that the representation of some other client will be materially limited. So it's a pretty not a particularly well-defined standard, and we're probably not going to go into a lot of detail on it today. I guess the main thing I should point out is if you do want a little bit further guidance, this is one case where the official comments following the rules provide a lot of examples and hypotheticals and cases talking about the common situations where conflict of interest would come into play. So I encourage you to read the commentary following the rule. Both the ABA commentary when the rules were originally put out and probably some additional comments that have been added by your state Supreme Court, because that's actually a fairly readable section of the commentary, and it guides you through some sticky situations. So like I say, we're not going to go into it in a lot of detail right now, but keep in mind that there is a lot to learn about conflicts of interest, and you have to watch out for them. I guess I will say probably the most common situation where you always have to be mindful of possible conflict of interest is the case of joint representation. If you're representing two individuals, or perhaps an individual and the corporate employer or something like that, usually that's okay. You know, the main rule says that you can't represent one client who is adverse to another client. Well, oftentimes they'll start out not being adverse. But at some point during the course of the proceedings, you have to always be mindful of your two joint clients. If their interests diverge at some point, well, at that point, then there's a conflict of interest. So normally it's okay for you to represent two people, but you always have to be mindful that there's a potential for a conflict of interest. Conflicts of interest, of course, like anything, can be consented to. So if you're if your clients realize what the conflict is and consent to you proceeding nonetheless, that's okay, unless it's that extreme situation where you're where it's an assertion of a claim by one client against another client in the same litigation. That's such an extreme case that that can't be waived. So you can't represent both the plaintiff and the defendant as they sue each other and, you know, cross-examine each of your clients. The one sticky situation in Minnesota, it's very rare for one attorney to represent both spouses. Although theoretically, or both divorcing spouses, I should say. Theoretically, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, it would be possible to do that. It would be possible for the attorney to jointly represent the two divorcing spouses. Although that's so fraught with peril, I would not do it in any state, although potentially it might be possible. Well, Iowa has a black and white rule saying that you can never do that. So in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and other states, it might be theoretically possible in some very rare case. In fact, I believe Minnesota still has a provision for something called a joint petition for dissolution of marriage that is very, very rarely used. Well, in one of those rare situations, the Minnesota attorney could represent both spouses, but in Iowa they could not. And in Minnesota it would be very ill-advised to do that because it's almost always going to be an assertion of a claim by one of your clients against the other, except in some extremely rare situation. So that's about all we're going to say about the general rule against conflicts of interest. Don't do them because they're a violation of the rule. But like I say, if you want to learn more, reading that commentary, I think, is really helpful. At this point, we're going to give the first code number for this hour of the program, for hour two of our ethics program. And our first code number this hour is E687. E as in ethics, 687. E687 is our first code number for this part of the program. And then we move on to Rule 1.8, which does have a lot of specificity. And we're going to spend some time on Rule 1.8 because it's a lot of very specific rules. But don't get the impression that Rule 1.8 is a more important conflict of interest rule simply because we're going to spend more time on it. No, the real important rule about conflicts of interest is Rule 1.7, the general rule saying that you can't engage in conflicts of interest. Rule 1.8 covers a lot of specific situations where the general rule, kind of specific situations showing how to apply the general rule in some very specific situations. But don't get the idea that Rule 1.8 is more important, because most of the things we're going to 1.8 never come up in the day-to-day practice of law. But you want to know that you have very specific guidance in those cases, whereas in the general, can I represent both of these clients, that kind of situation, you're a little bit more on your own. But in some of these more obscure situations, there's a general rule. So we're going to cover, we're going to spend some time covering these obscure rules simply because of the format of this course where we're talking about what the rules actually say. But again, Rule 1.7 is the most important rule. But we'll start by some of these obscure situations. Well, the first one's not all that obscure. It probably arises almost every representation to a certain extent. And it says you can never enter into a transaction with a client where you get an interest adverse to your client. Well, you almost always do because, you know, the client has to pay you. So they're not talking so much about that. But any time you enter into any kind of a business transaction with somebody who is also a client, that's potentially an adverse interest against your client. Your client owes you money, or you owe your client money, or you have a security interest in your client's property. Any time like that, you have to watch out because this rule comes into play. It's permissible as long as you comply with this rule. And the conditions are first of all, the transaction has to be fair and reasonable. The client has to consent to it. But the one thing you have to watch out for is that you need to advise your client in writing to obtain outside legal advice. So you have to, say, "Dear Mr. Client, we have an interest adverse to you because of this business transaction. Therefore, I think it's a good idea for you to talk to an outside attorney and see if this is really a good idea." You have to give that advice. They don't have to follow it, but you have to give them that advice. And I had one person who took this program a while back who told me after the program that he got himself a private reprimand because of a violation of this rule. And he seemed like a pretty ethical kind of person. But what happened was he was married to somebody, and he worked for the wife's family business. So his wife's parents also happened to be his client, so he was general counsel for the family company or whatever. During the course of the marriage, the family or the in-laws or the wife's parents loaned the couple money to for a down payment on a house or something. So he was in a position where he had an interest adverse to his client. He owed his client money because he had this loan from them. Well, the marriage didn't last, and they wound up in divorce court, and apparently it turned into kind of a nasty divorce. And at some point, somebody marched into the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility and pointed to this rule. The wife's parents went in there and said, our attorney entered into a business transaction with us, he was our client, and he owed us money, and he entered into this business transaction. They asked, did you consent to it? Oh, yeah, we consented. Was the transaction fair and reasonable? Well, yes, it was fair and reasonable. Well, then what's your complaint? Our attorney did not advise us in writing about the need to obtain outside legal advice, and sure enough, he hadn't. After getting that loan from his in-laws, he should have sat down and written a thank you letter and, put at the bottom, P.S., you should talk to an outside attorney about this. But he failed to do that, I think the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility saw that they were just getting involved in the fallout from a bitter divorce. But on the other hand, rules are rules. So he wound up with a private reprimand as a result of that violation. So watch out for that. Anytime you engage in any kind of a business transaction with your client, it's a good idea to remind your client in writing about the need to obtain outside legal advice. Let's see, gifts from clients. That never happens to me too often. Your clients can give you gifts. There's nothing wrong with that, according to this rule. But what you're not allowed to do is you're not allowed to solicit a substantial gift. You can't, say to your millionaire client, it would be nice if you gave me a substantial gift. Don't do that. It's okay if they just do it to their own volition, I guess. But you can't solicit a substantial gift. But more importantly, what you can't do is you can't draft the document that puts that gift into effect. In other words, you can't be the lawyer who writes a will naming yourself as a beneficiary of the estate of the client. So any kind of a document, a will, a deed, your client wants to give you some property, so they sign a quitclaim deed over to you. Well, you can't be the one to sign that deed. Or even a check is an instrument. So, your client, gives you a blank check. Well, you're not allowed to fill in the blank because that's drafting the instrument. So you have to hand the blank check back to them and say, you write in the amount. You can't draft the instrument unless the person is a relative. If the client is related to you, well, then it's okay. Now, you should still be very careful. That's what the rule says in Minnesota and Iowa and most other states. Wisconsin goes into a lot more specificity, and even though you might not be taking this program for Wisconsin credit, you'll want to pay attention to the Wisconsin rules. Because the reason why Wisconsin has a lot more specific rule is we have to remember that the rule that we're talking about here is the question of whether or not you are going to get disbarred for drafting this will, whether you're going to get in any disciplinary trouble for drafting the document. This rule does not answer the question that may be more important to you at that point, namely, will the court honor this will? You know, your client wrote a will giving you $1 million. Well, it's great that you didn't get disbarred because the person was a relative, but you also want to make sure that you actually get the money. And the rule in Minnesota and Iowa does not answer that question of whether or not you're going to get the money. That's up to the probate court. Well, in Wisconsin, what they did is they kind of rewrote this version of the rule in such a way so that the result is the same, whether or not you're before the Supreme Court getting your license revoked, or if you're in the probate court, and the probate court is deciding whether or not you're going to get the money. The same test applies. And the test applied in Wisconsin are these old, you know, some 1840 case involving the issue of the common law rule in Wisconsin. And chances are the common law rule in Minnesota and Iowa and just about any other state is about the same. So you want to, so even if you're not a Wisconsin attorney and worrying about getting disbarred in Wisconsin, well, you still want to pay attention to this Wisconsin rule because this is the test that the probate court will be using in this, probably in deciding whether or not you're going to get your money. So we want to take a close look at this Wisconsin rule. In Wisconsin, in order to keep yourself from getting disbarred, and probably in any state to make sure that you're actually going to get the money from the probate court, the following tests have to be met. First of all, as in the general rule, the client has to be a relative, but not just any relative. For purposes of the common law probate rule, you have to be the natural object of the bounty of the client, meaning that you are the type of relative who would normally get a gift of this magnitude. So in other words, you know, if you're drafting a will for your parents and you're the only child, well, you're probably the natural object of the bounty of their estate. On the other hand, you know, if you're drafting the will for your third cousin and lo and behold, you get the entire estate and closer relatives are cut out, well, then you're probably not the natural object of the bounty, even though that person might technically be a relative. The amount of the gift has to be reasonable and natural. There can't be any reasonable ground to think that the will be contested, and there can't be any risk that the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. Because as you know, we are all held to a very high ethical standard by everyone. Everyone loves lawyers. They realize that we're ethical, honest people. They never tell jokes about us or anything like that. Well, if they caught wind of the fact that you drafted this will, that might spoil it for all of us. They'll learn about this will and they'll lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. And we don't want that to happen. So if there's any risk of that happening, you will get disbarred in Wisconsin. And in most other states, you probably won't get the money that you were expecting to get from this will. Now, you look at that rule and... In Wisconsin or Minnesota or Iowa or just about any place, it's probably okay for you to draft the will for your parents or for very close relatives, and you can probably pass these tests. But on the other hand, you run a big risk if you do that because these are not particularly objective standards. You know, are you the natural object of the bounty? Will the public lose confidence in the integrity of the bar? You run the risk of the probate judge simply not liking you for some reason and deciding that in this case the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. So that's probably not a risk you want to take. So even when close relatives come to you wanting to draft the will, if you think you're going to be a beneficiary, that's one case where you should probably send them to some other colleague, and then you don't have to worry about that. So don't write wills where you're the beneficiary. It's probably the easy way to err on the side of caution in that rule. Next rule never comes up too often, I don't think, but there is a rule covering it. You can't get literary rights resulting from the representation until the case is concluded. So, the crime of the century goes down and the defendant walks into your office wanting representation. They don't have any money to pay you, but you know this is going to be a huge book deal coming out of this. So your client says, well, can I just sign you over the book rights from this representation? And the answer is no, you can't do that. Because once you do that, then your interests are different from your client, because at that point your client just wants to get off. On the other hand, you have an interest in making the case a little bit more dramatic. So there's just a per se rule that you're not allowed to do that. The next one probably comes up a little bit more often. You can't provide financial assistance to a client. So I guess that's a nice rule to have. You know, your client needs some money, and to provide some financial assistance to me, and you say, well, I would love to, but unfortunately, Rule 1.8 says that I can't give you any financial assistance, so I can't do that. And there's an exception for costs of litigation and so forth, so you can take a look at that. Your fee being paid by somebody else. Normally, that's okay. And I had one criminal defense attorney tell me the identity of this person who was going to be paying your fee, and that person's name was Mom. You have this criminal defendant, and the criminal defendant can't afford to pay you, so Mom shows up with the checkbook. It sounds like this criminal defense attorney I talked to, it sounds like most of his income comes from Mom paying for the representation of her son. Well, that's perfectly fine. The client has to consent to it. So you go down to the jail and say, hey, is it okay if Mom pays my fee? And he'll probably say yes. There's an exception in Wisconsin if you're appointed at government expense, so they don't necessarily have to consent to the public defender. And it can't, but more importantly, it can't interfere with your independence, and confidential information seems to be protected. This attorney kind of, one problem that he noticed quite often was, Mom wrote him a check to pay the fee. Well, then Mom sometimes wanted some say in how the case was going to be carried out. But no, this rule says that that can't be. So if Mom, who's paying the bills, wants to do one thing, and the son, who's locked up in jail, wants to do something else, then you have to do what your client tells you to do, not necessarily the person who is paying your fee. And as a practical matter, he reminded me that as a practical matter, Mom does not understand this. So you have to get the money up front because when the person paying the fee realizes that their instructions are not being carried out well, then sometimes they stop paying the fee. So it's okay for somebody else other than the client to pay your fee, but you have to watch out. And that could oftentimes be an insurance company, too. So you're the insurance defense attorney. The insurance company is paying your fee. That is okay. Wisconsin addresses one issue in that context that says, the client has to consent, but they don't necessarily have to consent today. It's sufficient that they consented to this you being paid by the insurance company back when they took out the insurance policy. Other states don't have that written into the rules, although I suspect most of them would probably come down the same way. If you're representing more than one party, an aggregate settlement has to be approved by all of your clients. That seems kind of obvious to me, and I always wondered why that was in the rules. Then I was reminded why by an attorney who pointed out that what this rule is in there really to do is to reiterate the fact that if you're representing multiple defendants and a settlement offer is presented to you, then each individual defendant does indeed have the right to be the holdout and say, no, I'm not going to sign on this aggregate settlement. So that issue can come up if you're representing multiple defendants. And then, of course, you have a conflict of interest. So like I say, whenever you're representing multiple parties, keep in mind that that's a possibility. Never ask your client to prospectively waive a malpractice claim. Whether or not you are guilty of malpractice, simply asking them to please don't sue me for malpractice that is a violation of this rule, unless they're independently represented by an attorney. So you can't prospectively waive it. You can waive malpractice claims that took place in the past because, you know, in order to settle it, but you can't ask a prospective waiver. You can't put in your retainer agreement, you know, that, you know, I, the client, promise never to sue you, the attorney, for malpractice. Because even if you don't commit malpractice, that's a violation. And you should never, never, never ask your clients not to turn you into the disciplinary authorities. Because even if you didn't do anything wrong, simply uttering those words, saying, please don't turn me in, well, that's a violation of this rule. So don't do that. You can't get a proprietary interest in a cause of action with subject to an exception that is kind of swallows up the rule in some cases. You can get a reasonable contingent fee as long as you have complied with all those rules back in Rule 1.5 about contingent fees, then it's permissible. But an unauthorized contingent fee, in addition to being a violation of Rule 1.5, is also a violation of this rule. A lawyer may not have sexual relations with a client unless that relationship predated the legal representation. So that's it for Rule 1.8, and Rule 1.8 concludes simply by saying that with the exception of that last rule, the last paragraph, any prohibition, any conflict of interest is imputed. So if you are prohibited from taking the case, then every attorney in your firm is also prohibited from taking the case. And we'll go into a little bit more detail about that in Rule 1.10, but in general, the general rule is conflicts of interest run with the firm. So if your partner, for whatever reason, can't take a case because of a conflict of interest, then you probably can't either. That's the general rule. At this point, I'm going to go ahead and give the second code number for this portion of the program. Our next code number is E699. E as in ethics, 699. E699. E699 is our next code number. Rule 1.9, up until now we've been talking about your present clients. Rule 1.9 talks about your duties to your former clients. This rule is looks a little bit more complicated than it really is, because the conflict of interest rule is not worded particularly well. But that doesn't matter, because most of the time when you're talking about your former client, the issue is resolved with respect to the confidentiality rules. Because, as you remember, under Rule 1.6, everything that happens within the course of a representation is confidential, and you cannot reveal that information other than for proper purposes, and you can't use that information. Well, Rule 1.9 makes clear that it makes no difference whatsoever with respect to confidentiality, whether your client is your present client or your former client. The same rules apply. So in other words, that confidentiality remains long after the attorney-client relationship is over. The rule is you can't, you can't switch sides in the middle of the case. That's a pretty obvious one. But the most important part of it here is in the third paragraph, I believe, of my materials. A lawyer may not use information regarding the representation of a former client to that client's disadvantage. So in other words, anything you learn in the course of that first representation, which everything is presumptively confidential, you can never use that in any way that's to the disadvantage of that former client. Well, since everything is confidential, you know, if any disadvantage to your former client comes up in any way whatsoever, well, then it's a violation of the rule. So I think this one, it's a good idea, I think, to err on the side of caution and never, never go against a former client in any way, because, everything was confidential, so anything you learned during the course of that first case, if you have to use it, even if you could have learned it some other way, well, that's a violation of Rule 1.9. So I think on this one you should err on the side of caution and don't go suing your former clients. although theoretically there might be some cases where it's possible, and then you want to dig a little bit more deeply into Rule 1.9, because there might be, you know, if it was so long ago that all that confidential information is just has no relevance whatsoever, well, then maybe it's possible. Then you want to look carefully at Rule 1.9. But in general, you don't want to sue former clients or go adverse to them in any way. Not so much because of the conflict of interest rules, but because of the confidentiality rules. So as I promised at the end of Rule 1.8, I said that all conflicts of interest are imputed, or most of them are. If you are prohibited from representing somebody, that means that every attorney in your firm is similarly prohibited. So if your partner or your associate or your employee has a conflict of interest, well, then you have a conflict of interest too. Rule 1.10 goes into a little bit more detail about how that affects your employability. In other words, you change jobs. Rule 1.10 says that when you get a new job, you bring your conflicts of interest with you. So you represented the Acme Widget Company a number of years ago when you were in private practice or for a different firm. And then you come to work for me. You have a conflict of interest against the Acme Widget Company because they're your former client. You have all kinds of confidential information. You come to work for me. Well, I now have a conflict of interest against the Acme Widget Company, so I can't sue them. Or let's put it the other way around. Let's say I'm here in Minnesota, so we have a lot of big employers here, like 3M. So let's say I was the in-house counsel for 3M, and I worked for 3M. And then I come to work for you. You hire me, you have a conflict of interest against 3M. A client hobbles into your office who is injured by some defective 3M product. You start to tell him, well, I'm sorry, I can't take your case because we have this conflict of interest in our firm. Well, you start saying that, then you realize, well, wait a minute, what's more important to me, having Clem work for me or to have this lucrative case come into the office? And you correctly decide that having that lucrative case against my former client is probably more worthwhile to you than whatever services I've been providing for you. So you send me on my way. You fire me. This rule says that I then take that conflict of interest with me. So I came to your office with baggage, namely this conflict of interest. Once I leave your company or once I leave your firm, I take that baggage with me, and I no longer have that conflict of interest. So this Rule 1.10 basically says that conflicts of interest are your baggage. You have to worry about it while I'm still working for you, but you don't have to worry about the former clients of your former employees. And there are a couple of exceptions, kind of common sense ones. Obviously, if I shared a lot of confidential information with you, while I was in your employ, well, then you're probably still precluded. But the general rule is that I bring my conflicts of interest with me, but then I take them with me when I go to work elsewhere. That's the rule on conflicts of interest are imputed, and Rule 1.10 gives some details on how that applies in the case of attorneys changing jobs. And at this point, I'm going to go ahead and give the next code number for this hour of the program. Our next code number is E624. E624. E as in ethics, 624. E624 is our next code number. Well, Rule 1.11 has some special rules about former government lawyers. Rule 1.11 does two things. First of all, it says that, for any former government employee, it first of all says that if I used to work for the government, then any confidential information I learned during my government employment, not necessarily as an attorney, Rule 1.11 states that I can never use that confidential information against the people who provided it to the government. So in other words, before becoming an attorney, I worked in the mail room of the IRS, opening all of the tax returns. And I happened to have a photographic memory. So as I opened up all the 1040 forms that came in, I memorized all the information. So I have a treasure trove of personal financial data about millions of people. Well, Rule 1.11 says I can't use that, even though I wasn't an attorney back then. That confidential information remains confidential forever. But the other part of Rule 1.11 talks is an exception, kind of a watered-down version of the conflict of interest rules for former government lawyers. Because if you strictly applied all those previous rules, well, then former government employees might become unemployable. So, for example, if you worked as a prosecutor for the Polk County District Attorney's Office, well, you prosecuted all kinds of people in the name of the state of Iowa. So who was your former client? Well, your former client was the state of Iowa. Well, if you strictly applied a lot of those previous rules, well, then you would be kind of unemployable because you could never go up against your former client, the state of Iowa. So in other words, you can't practice criminal law anymore. Well, the Rule 1.11 recognizes that that would be kind of a silly result. So in the case of former government lawyers, the prohibition applies not. You don't worry about who the former client was. You worry about what the former case was. So you can still work. You can still work for a law firm that takes cases against the state of Iowa, but you just can't. You can't be involved in cases that you personally were involved with when you were a prosecuting attorney. Well, even there, though, that might still limit your employability, especially if you're in a smaller county. You know, you're the district attorney in a county, and maybe you're I don't know if any counties are small enough to have part-time district attorneys, but you're the county attorney in a small county, and you have a private practice as well. Or you leave your office and you go to private practice. Well, just you were personally involved in every single case that was there. Well, you are still prohibited from taking any part in those cases in which you personally participated, but the rule recognizes that you can still go to work for a firm that was representing the people in those cases you were personally involved with, but you need to be screened off from that. Your new firm is not allowed to talk to you at all about that case, and you can't share any portion of the fee. And you also have to send a letter to the government agency. So you send a letter to your former boss or the newly elected county attorney saying, I'm working for this firm, and I was personally involved in these cases, but don't worry, I'm screened off. The agency does not need to consent, but you do need to inform them. Rule 1.11 also talks about when you are a government employee, you cannot solicit employment with the adverse parties. So you can't, during a break in the proceedings, go talk to the defense attorney about joining their firm. And there's even an exception for that for a judicial law clerk. Okay, and Rule 1.12 basically says the same thing with respect to former judges. So if you're a former judge, the same rule applies to you. You can't represent people where you were personally involved as a judge, but you could potentially work for a law firm that appeared before you, but you have to be screened off from those cases. And then hopefully after a while those cases work their way through the system. And Rule 1.12 also applies to arbitrators or mediators. So even if you're not a former judge, but you're ever involved in an arbitration or mediation, that could potentially apply to you. Okay, so that's... So those are the rules about conflict of interest. And like I say, remember, Rule 1.7 is the important rule, and it's the one rule we didn't talk very much about. Be a good idea occasionally to review the commentary following Rule 1.7. Rule 1.13 talks about the special case of your client being an organization. So you're not representing an individual, you're representing the corporation or an organization or a government agency or something like that. This rule just makes clear that your client is your client, even though you're dealing with individuals within that organization. You have to always be aware of the fact that your loyalty goes to the organization, not necessarily individuals. Well, sometimes people don't understand that. So if you encounter a situation where you are acting in the best interest of the corporation and an employee of the corporation gets the mistaken impression that you are their lawyer, that you're acting in their best interest, well, you have an affirmative obligation to clear up that misunderstanding. Also, because your duty of loyalty is to your client, the organization, you have a duty, if you discover wrongdoing within the organization, to become a whistleblower, maybe. So if you bring this illegal activity to your boss's attention and your boss brushes it off, well, your boss is not the client. The corporation is the client. So you have an obligation to go higher up the chain of command and bring that to their attention, or maybe even be a whistleblower, call up the rat on your client. Now, you would not want to do that lightly because obviously you have a duty of loyalty or of confidentiality to your client. But if it's a situation where there's ongoing wrongdoing, and you realize that by being a whistleblower and turning your client in, you'll put an end to the ongoing wrongdoing, well, then the fact that you've prevented this future liability for wrongdoing might outweigh the penalties that your client is going to incur from the past wrongdoing. I would not do that lightly. You know, call up the EPA and tell them that your client is dumping toxic waste, but you might have an obligation to do that in some rare cases. I'll give another code number at this point. Our next code number for this hour of the program is E. let's start that over. Our next code number is E611. E611 is our next code number. Client with diminished capacity. There's a rule here because, as you recall, Rule 1.2, which I told you is arguably the most important rule, says you always have to follow your client's instructions unless you can come up with a specific exception. Well, Rule 1.14 is one case where you have a specific exception. If your client is wants you to do something that you don't think is a good idea, normally you have to do it because your client decides whether or not it's a good idea. But if your client wants to do something that's a bad idea because of a diminished capacity, because of health reasons or age or something like that, if it's an identifiable diminished capacity, this gives you the authorization to violate Rule 1.2, or it's a defense to Rule 1.2. So I guess the long and short is anytime you're going to go against your client's stated wishes, the burden of proof is kind of on you to show that there was a diminished capacity, not just that you had a differing opinion with your client. And this rule makes clear that ability to go against their wishes might even entail going against their confidentiality. So if your elderly client is going to become a victim of some kind of a scam or something, well, normally your client has the right to become a victim of a scam if they want to. But Rule 1.14 would give you the authority to talk to their family members or whatever, saying, I think your elderly relative is going to do something foolish here, and maybe we have to think about a guardianship or something. So Rule 1.14 is kind of an exception to Rule 1.2. If there's a diminished capacity, well, then you do have authority to go against your client's stated wishes. That rule does not say that you have to go against your client's stated wishes, although your general duty of competency would probably say that you have to. Rule 1.15, as you see in the written material here, there's a lot of stuff, and we're going to blast through it pretty fast because it differs from state to state here a little bit. And I'll tell you where to look in your particular state for details. But you have to safeguard your client's property, and you have to safeguard your client's money. You have to act, you can't be negligent with their property. But most of what Rule 1.15 is talking about is the various trust account rules. And those trust account rules can get very specific. So we're not going to go into them in detail, but I'll tell you in a minute where to find them. But the overarching rule is that any time money comes into your hands in connection with a representation, and if that money does not belong to you, in other words, if the money belongs to your client or if the money belongs to a third party, that money has to be kept segregated from your money. So in other words, it has to go in the trust account. There are two kinds of trust accounts. Normally, it would be what's called your IOLTA account or your LTAB account. It might have different names in different states, but your attorney's trust account, it has to go in there. And that's kind of a totally absolute rule to which there are no exceptions, that money cannot be in your personal account for even a short period of time. All that money has to go in your trust account. The corollary to that rule is that your money cannot be in the trust account with two exceptions for your money being in the trust account. First of all, money belonging to you and the client jointly goes into the trust account before being dispersed. So like the settlement in a civil case, you get one check made payable to you and the client. That goes in the trust account, and then you cut two checks, one to your client, one to you. And the other exception is a reasonable amount necessary to cover bank service charges. I've been told that, and this is kind of the number that I tossed around that I thought was reasonable, and one Iowa attorney told me that he was told the same number by the authorities in Iowa, and that is $100. You can keep $100 of your money in your trust account to cover bank service charges as they come in. But you can't keep $1,000 in there because that's not a reasonable amount to cover bank service charges. So in other words, you can't count on the fact of, oops, this check was off by a few dollars, but that's okay. There's enough money in there to cover it. You're not allowed to do that. You can't just keep a cushion in your trust account. So the moral of the story is you have to keep very, very good records on your trust account. And what records do you have to keep? Fortunately for those of us in Minnesota and Iowa, the state has a web page. Our state Supreme Court has a web page telling you exactly what you have to keep. So please consult those. They are listed in the materials here. It's a good idea to look those documents over once a year, just to make sure that your books and records are all up to date, because they do have a tendency to change. And those cover not just your trust account records, but other financial records that you are required to keep. And those web pages are adopted by reference into the rules, so you're bound by those, even though they're not actually in the rules. So be sure and look at your state's version of that. I believe I also have the Nebraska version here. Keep your eye open for those. Now, the Wisconsin version of the rule goes into a lot more detail because those are built right into the rule. So if you're in Wisconsin, you find all those details by looking at Wisconsin Rule of Professional Conduct 1.15, and they have all the nuts and bolts right in there. Be careful about taking credit cards if that credit card money goes into your trust account. That's one thing to watch out for because there are very specific rules. In fact, the Wisconsin rules go into excruciating detail almost to the point of making it impossible. Saying, so if your client needs to put money in the trust account by means of a credit card, send them to the bank and tell them to get a cash advance and come back with an envelope of money because that will be a lot less paperwork than trying to get credit card payments into your trust account. Our next code number for this segment of the program is E637. And one thing I'll point out, some of you taking this will be in Minnesota. The rules are different in the different states. So if you're admitted in more than one state, you better make sure, or it's probably a good idea to make sure that you're complying as much as possible anyway with the rules in the other state. When we get to the very last rule at the end of the last hour of this program, we'll see that while there are choice of law rules and probably it's governed by the state where you have your main location, but in some cases, the rules are a little bit conflicting from state to state. And one example that I can think of is that I would be in violation of the Wisconsin Rules of Professional Conduct because of the way my trust account is set up, because the Wisconsin rule says that the word trust account has to appear on the checkbook. My checks have the word trust account printed on them. But it also says that they have to appear on the bank statement. So when the bank mails out the statement, it has to come addressed to Richard P. Clem Trust Account. Well, in Minnesota, that's not a requirement, and my trust account bank statement does not come addressed that way. It has an abbreviation. It comes addressed to Richard P. Clem MNLTAB, which stands for Lawyers Trust Account Board. Well, that is not allowed in Wisconsin. You have to have the words trust account spelled out. So if I was also admitted in Wisconsin, it would probably be worthwhile calling the bank, saying, can you fix the bank statement so it has the right language for Wisconsin? Let's see. I think I gave the last code number. Let me give it again just in case. E-637. I think I already gave that. Okay, so that's rule 1.15, rule 1.15. So make sure that you read those web pages that apply to your state. Rule 1.16 talks about the situations where you may or must decline representation. You must decline representation, or fire your client if the representation will result in a violation of the rules, such as a conflict of interest. Your physical condition just impairs your ability that you can't represent them, or if you're fired. So in other words, if you're fired, yes, your client has the absolute authority to fire you at any time. Even if it's a violation, even if it's in breach of contract, they still have the right to fire you, and you can't keep representing them once they say that you're fired. The situations where you may withdraw are... it's kind of a long list here, and the last one says other good cause exists. And you can always find, these seven things here, you can always find a reason to quit. So we can just say categorically that you can quit whenever you want, except, and there's an exception. Even though you're permitted to withdraw, the lawyer must comply with any law requiring notice or permission by the court. So if the court rules say that you have to give notice, or the court rules say that you have to seek leave of court before withdrawing, well, that rule trumps the rules of professional conduct. So even though this rule says that you can quit whenever you feel like it, it doesn't use those words, but that's kind of what it says, even though that's what this rule says, you're still bound by that other more restrictive rule. And, for example, in Minnesota, that means in a criminal case you can never withdraw until the case is over. Regardless of whether or not you're paid, because as a practical matter, under the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure, you have to ask for leave of court to withdraw, and as a practical matter, the judge will always say no. So get paid up front in your criminal cases. If you do quit, you have to take reasonable steps to protect your client's interests. You can't just leave them totally in the lurch. And you have to give them back their papers. Now, it says here you have to give them back their file if the client is entitled to them. Well, unfortunately, the client is entitled to them. The reason why those words are included there are, if you drafted some document that the client hasn't paid for, well, then maybe you don't have to give them that document. But you have to give them back the rest of their file. The papers belong to the client. You have to give them back. I guess you can ask the client to, you are allowed to make copies, and I guess you can even ask the client to pay for those copies, but you can't condition return of the documents upon payment of those copying costs. Rule 1.17 says that you can sell a law practice as a going business, but it has to be a bona fide sale of the business. You can't just you can't use this as a ruse for collecting referral fees. And then Rule 1.18 talks about your duties to a prospective client. And a prospective client is defined as somebody who communicates with you for the purposes of establishing an attorney-client relationship. If somebody communicates with you, that makes them a prospective client. And this rule says that that communication is just as confidential as if they had been an actual client. So if somebody comes to you and communicates information because they want to hire an attorney, well, then all that information is confidential, and it can never be used against that person. Now, is this rule subject to abuse? Yes, it is. And I've heard many stories of this happening where, I come to your town, and I get in some trouble, and I know I'm going to get sued as a result of this trouble. I've resigned myself to the fact that I'm going to get sued, but I want to make sure that you are not the attorney suing me because you're the best attorney in town. So what I do is I come into your office and I start blurting out information that's damaging to me. And I know full well that you don't want to represent me. You want to represent the people I injured. Was that tactic successful? Yes, it was. I kept you off the case by blurting out that information to you. That's kind of unfair, so there's a minor exception to that that says if you took reasonable precautions to keep me from blurting out that information, unfortunately, you're still off the case, but at least your partner and other members of your firm are able to take the case. So watch out. If you see me coming in that situation, send somebody out to head me off, knowing that that person will not be able to take the case. But you sit in your office, lock the door, and cover your ears so you don't hear any of the stuff that I'm blurting out. Then you'll be okay. Well, there, after almost 2 hours, we've finished Rule 1. I'm going to, in this, we still have a few minutes left in this hour of the program, so we'll move on to Rule 2, which will go much faster because Rule 1 talked about your relationship with your client, which is obviously the most important part of the practice of law. But the rules cover some other topics, and now we'll turn to those. Rule 2 goes a lot faster. It just talks about some of the different functions that we as attorneys have. It says that if we're an advisor, in advising our client, you can give them advice. You're not required to, but you can give advice that goes beyond strictly legal advice. So, yes, you can give moral, economic, social, and political advice if so inclined, in addition to the legal advice. There is no Rule 2.2 in Minnesota or Iowa or Wisconsin, but there is a Rule 2.3, and then also in some states the rule number is a little bit different. For example, Nebraska, the following rule is numbered Rule 2.2, but in most other states they stuck with the old numbering, which is 2.3. Evaluating and giving an opinion to a third party about your client's case, either formally or informally. That's a perfectly permissible thing to do. We do that all the time, write opinion letters of different kinds. Rule 2.3 just makes clear that if you're going to say something bad about your client, well, then you better make sure that it's informed consent that you have. Rule 2.4, if you're a third-party neutral, such as an arbitrator or mediator, then you have to, and people are mixed up as to your role in the case, then you have to clear that up. And that's numbered differently in Nebraska and some other states. We're almost at an hour. I'm going to continue here for a few minutes on Rule 3 because Rule 3 maybe before you take the next hour, you can just browse through Rule 3.1, 3.2, 3.3, and so forth, because we're going to blast through them pretty quickly. Not because this is unimportant. This is some of the most important parts of the rules, but I'm sure all of you are ethical people, and you would not do any of the stuff in Rule 3. Because you're a good ethical attorney, and you're not going to destroy evidence. You're not going to lie to the judge. You're not going to do any of this stuff in Rule 3. So we're going to gloss over it, and we're not going to go into it in too much detail because, first of all, you wouldn't do any of the stuff anyway because you're a good person. Number two, if you were going to do this stuff, it's not going to help if I tell you not to. You know, so if I tell you, please don't lie in court, well, it's not going to do any good if you were predisposed to doing that. So we're not going to belabor these rules. But maybe, like I say, look them over before you take the next segment of the course. But what we are going to spend some time when we come back tomorrow or in the next portion of the podcast, we are going to look at some situations where even though you and I are good ethical people, well, there are some things that we should do that that might get close to violating some of these, that it actually is the right thing for us to be doing, but you have to be careful about some of these rules. So we will talk about that in a little bit more detail in the next hour. But like I say, it'd probably be a good idea to look through the Rule 3.1, 3.2, 3.3, and so forth before the next hour. At this point, I will pause for any questions from those taking the conference call. Well, not hearing any at this point. If you're taking the podcast and you have any questions about this portion of the program, feel free to email those to me or give me a call, and I'll answer them within the time permitted by the rules. So thank you once again for joining us today, and I look forward to seeing you either in the next hour or at a future program. So thanks, and have a great day. Bye.